Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. Your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra's conductor laureate, Christopher Seaman, is back in town for a program that includes one of Mozart's finest musical moments and a taste of the chilly north. Joining him on stage and in our studios is pianist Joyce Yang. Welcome both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So nice to have you here and nice to have you back. We have three great works from a couple of different eras. Let's start, Christopher, if you don't mind. Is this the first time you've worked together?
Oh, no. We've done quite a few things, including Rochester. One summer we played in a tent on the car park.
And it rained?
Well, there were planes going over. Do you remember the weather, Joyce?
I certainly do. I think it was like an instrument that Rachmaninoff never wrote in the score.
But you remember it, and that's so nice.
Oh, yes.
Memories, where would we be without them? With Joyce, you're going to be working with the maestro. I'm playing some Mozart, a great Mozart. But let's start with the Lenore Overture. This is Lenore Overture number 3 by Beethoven. It was for his big opera, Fidelio. He really had kind of a rough time getting it going, though.
Well, what it was is that he wrote Lenore number 3, but it actually tells you the story of the opera in so much detail that he thought he'd given the game away. So he kept it as a separate piece and wrote another 3 overtures. And the actual overture to Fidelio is the one that's now played before the opera. But sometimes this overture is played between 2 of the acts. But it gave the game away. That's why he wasn't happy with it. It's a masterpiece.
But this particular overture, however, has done extremely well in the Straight Concert Hall.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's actually, when I say it's too good to be an opera overture, don't take that the wrong way, but it's so complete and it tells so much of the story of the opera. I just think he felt by the time they've heard the overture, they don't need the opera, they know the story.
What makes this work so well as an overture? Why does it work on its own?
Well, it's superbly constructed in a symphonic kind of way. It's very dramatic. You feel at the beginning it's descending into darkness. You get a ray of hope, and then you get a very strong, quicker allegro section, which stops dramatically for an offstage trumpet call. And this is the sound of victory coming. You see the distant trumpets giving one hope. And then once we've had the 2 trumpet calls, it goes to a very exciting conclusion. So it's superbly put together, a wonderful, exciting finish as well.
The next piece up is Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24. This is a late work for him, and it's only 1 of 2 in a minor key. This has no cadenzas, Joyce Yang, is that correct?
That is correct, and it gives pianists to really take that freedom to make your own, but this time I'm going to play one that's inspired by the version that Alicia de la Rocha wrote, which I grew up listening to, and I thought that was the Mozart cadenza. And later I found other versions, and I play a variety of them, but this one's the one I really feel closest to. And I just listened to a recording a few days ago, and it's a bit different than what I remember and learned, and it's not written, so it's just listening to it and kind of improvising on the theme of it. But I love it because she belts out this first theme that the audience hears in the first movement, and the pianists never get to play it. We come in playing some a different tune, and the main theme never gets repeated in the piano solo part, and that'll be the major feature in the cadenza.
Do you write your own, or have you written your own for this concerto?
I have not for this one. Just little bits here and there, little joints and little embellishments.
A lot of classical pianists are uncomfortable with the idea of writing a cadenza. Why is that?
I think as pianists, unless you are also a composer, very often I think we consider ourselves as messengers of music. We're interpreters of music. We see a great work and we bring it to life, and it's like delivering a very important message to the recipient. And to write the message from the scratch, I think it's a completely different creative process in a way. And very hard to write something original of our own. And I did write a few other ones that's for the Mozart Concerti, and I tell you, they just take months and months, and I can never make up my mind. And they're just, for me, what's difficult is there are limitless, endless choices, different routes I could take, and I can never pick a single thing in a store also. So it's, you can just imagine how long it takes me to write one note and spend the next 6 hours erasing it.
So do you just Google Mozart Cadenza Piano Concerto 24 and it comes up with possibilities for you?
I think it's not really written for most parts. Many pianists just play their own and they never publish it. So it's there are some different versions. Yeah, you can Google. You can find all kinds of things, but never really the one I felt convincing. I really liked what András Schiff does. And I played around with that idea. You sort of, not copy, but get inspirations from the different routes that they can take using Mozart's melodies. Whatever happens on stage, it's in... Even if you follow their blueprint, it's going to be somewhat of an improvisation in energy levels and whatnot, so it'll sound very different.
Well, it's a live performance, and that's the joy of it. Now, this particular concerto is also a little bigger in orchestra, is it not, Christopher?
Oh, yes. Well, it features every part of the orchestra in the most wonderful way, particularly the woodwind. And as you know, Mozart wrote a number of wonderful pieces for wind instruments. And so in this concerto, you get the symphonic side of Mozart, because it's superbly put together. It's on a very grand scale. You obviously get his piano writing. You get his opera, not with singers, but with the melodies. The slow movement could easily be a song, an aria from one of his operas. You get that, and so you get every aspect of Mozart really put together in one piece, which all the great piano concertos of his do have. But I must tell you one thing. Joyce was just talking about cadenzas, and one violinist wrote their own cadenzas for a very well-known violin concerto, not in the style. It was the Beethoven concerto. But the violinist did not do it in the style of Beethoven. They brought in all kinds of things that have happened since Beethoven's day, some very modern things, some jazzy things. And the conductor told me afterwards it was like putting a moustache on the Mona Lisa.
I guess this is actually something that somebody must be very careful about, is when you build your cadenza to be respectful of the source material.
Well, I mean, it depends what you mean by respect. I think this violinist would say that it was respectful to Beethoven, but it's not the kind of respect that Joyce and you and I happen to be talking about this afternoon.
Now, in this particular concerto, it's really structured very closely to what we now know as a romantic concerto. The first movement, very long, the longest of the three. Then you have the beautiful but fairly short middle movement, and then wrapping it all up with a run at the end of the third movement. So let's talk about that first movement and what happens in the first movement.
For me, I think it's a very ominous start. If you've never heard this piece, there would be quite a curiosity as to what's going to happen, because it's it opens with a question mark, and it goes through. It's like shifting clouds.
And it's dark.
It's dark. Yeah. It's brooding C minor, and very long introduction before the piano comes in. Not with the original melody that the orchestra played, and it's a lot of sort of exploring in very imaginative way. There are still times after playing it a thousand times, it's shocking that Mozart wrote what he wrote. It sounds so modern almost. It takes great harmonic risks and goes to such surprising places. As a pianist, it's a great challenge to play Mozart because it's such a delicate balance between, you know, weaving these perfect pearls into a necklace. I mean, they're, compared to a big romantic concerto, not many notes to work with. And many people think that that would be easier for me to play lesser notes and one line at a time, two lines at a time, instead of, you know, all 10 fingers going in all directions. But in a way, it's much harder because just like a perfect pearl necklace, you see the shade and the shape of each pearl, and everything needs to be just right for the moment to exist. And this piece, you cannot shy away from a moment either. It's this brooding C minor, so it needs that pulsating, that heart within it. And so I really want to dig deeper, and I do in certain times, but, you know, you go a little bit too far and then you might start drawing a mustache.
Christopher, the audience must have been baffled by this the first time it was ever performed.
I would have thought so. I've not read any description of that premiere. Did he play it himself, Joyce?
Yes.
He premiered it himself, yes.
That's why there are no cadenzas.
Yeah, of course, yes. Well, he premiered most of them, I think, in any way. But they would have been very surprised. But the factor that we have to remember is Mozart's personal presence, which was very strong, and his ability to create something quite extraordinary just by being himself and with all his genius. So to actually imagine Mozart sitting at the piano playing and directing an orchestra would put a different perspective on a piece that we might find quite shocking in a way. He would in a way sell it because of his superb playing and his presence and his artistry and his conducting. He obviously could conduct. Well, all the great composers could conduct.
Except for Beethoven. I hear he was
well,
not very
yes.
good.
Well, I think, he couldn't hear the orchestra well. May have been a slight handicap, although a number of very successful conductors don't hear the orchestra particularly well.
Anybody you want to talk about?
No names will be mentioned. No one who's ever been to Rochester, I can tell you that. No.
The second movement is so pretty, very short, very sweet. But you begin it, Joyce. You sort of set the tone for what happens in that second movement.
Yes, we travel to E flat major, and I start. Really, yes, there is an aria in the right hand, and I really, I think, imitate all kinds of the orchestra in the second movement. It's a dialogue between the woodwinds and the piano. And it goes through small hills, you find really surprising beauty in all kinds of places. But it's this, I really feel like I'm playing chamber music for the second movement, and I don't necessarily feel like I am the dominant, the force. I feel like I'm really part of the orchestra, which I feel very, very happy about.
This is a comment that I've heard several pianists say when they talk about playing other Mozart piano concertos, is that they feel like they're actually playing chamber music.
Yeah, I think it's there's definitely emphasis on a lot of the instruments in the orchestra as solo instruments. And I often feel like playing a piece like this, someone's responsible for the eye, someone, and then needs to respond to that shape of the eye and draw eyelashes on top of it. And then the next one, depending on what those two look like, then drawing the eyebrow. And we're sort of creating this this whole painting one step at a time, and everything needs to be sort of quote-unquote, in proportion for this movement to come together. And you can't really stick to your original plan. I mean, it might be very minuscule changes, but from performance to performance, it's really important that you react and you notice those little changes, because in Mozart, those small changes really make it or break the moment.
When you go to a piece like a movement like the second movement, Christopher, how much of it is sort of tamping down the orchestra, and how much of it is that it's just written that way and that's you don't have to do that? How do you keep from overwhelming?
Well, you just have to make sure that they don't play too loud, which you do by conducting small. And normally, Mozart had a wonderful ear for sound and for balance and orchestration. I mean, one of the very greatest, obviously, at that. And a lot of it looks after itself. But now and again, there's a very juicy bit to play on the strings, and everyone wants to get into it. But if they do really get into it, they might cover the piano. So you just had to be a little careful of that. But on the whole, it's just a question of everyone listening, being aware. This orchestra really does listen, and they really can play as chamber music, which we were doing, did you at the rehearsal this morning? Yeah.
And the third movement brings it all home in every sense of the word, because it goes back to the home key in the third movement.
It's a theme and variation movement, and there's a story. Beethoven heard this third movement and said, I will never write anything as great as this third movement. And there is, that's very telling. It's quite simple. There's no, it's not creating a melody. It just sort of, it exists in its simplest form, and it's spectacular. And it takes off in so many different in variations, and each one is more surprising.
They're changes of mood, aren't they? The mood changes the whole time. Some of them are dark and a little brooding, as you say, and then you get an incredibly cheerful, chirpy one.
Yes,
and this particular concerto was written, and this is something I've heard from each of you now: the use of aria, song, opera. He was actually writing Figaro at the same time as he was writing this and a couple of other concertos. So did these two worlds somehow come together?
Yes, they do. And once or twice I said to the orchestra, can you get a little bit more humor into it? Think of Figaro. Actually, I said that at the rehearsal. Mm. Yes.
So in this particular, now you talked about Beethoven's quote. Brahms said that this work was a masterpiece of art and full of inspired ideas. People love this concerto. Some say it's the finest concerto, maybe even the finest work that Mozart wrote. Why is this one so different from the rest? What is it that makes number 24 jump out? We'll start with you, Joyce.
I think it's a landscape that is very different from others. It has extreme angles in my mind. I always, you know, picture sounds with what I see. In a way, I'm quite synesthetic in ways that sounds spark colors and lines in my mind. And this has a very, very dramatic landscape and a very fleeting one. It's constantly shifting. It's a dangerous piece in my mind. It's something I can never really grab and keep it at a safe place. It sort of has this this energy that seems to be always a bit scary to play. It has this brooding quality that's very, it's unsettling and so beautiful at the same time. And it's this kind of an uncontrollable beauty that I get from this piece. And no matter how much you think about it, like my entrance in the first movements, you can actually never make up your mind where as to how I'm going to shape it in the concert. All I have are sketches of what could happen. But it's not a simple landscape where it's you say, oh, this is ascending, so I'm going to go up with each level. It's a little bit warped. All the movements can either go up or down, and it would work either way. It has this sort of a way about it where you can really hear different people, and it would just sound totally different depending on the interpretation. And I think it's one of those very sort of immortal pieces that you just never get sick and tired of thinking about or working on.
Christopher?
Yes, all that, of course, is true. It's very rich in inventiveness. It's very rich in melodic inventiveness and what he does with the melodies. And as Joyce said, with Mozart, it's never safe when he's happy. With Haydn, it's safe when he's happy. With Mozart, when he's happy, watch out. A cloud could come over the sun. And so it has that quicksilver quality to it, which is absolutely irresistible. And it hits every possible kind of emotion, the whole lot.
One of the things I've noticed, seeing a lot of Mozart in concert, is that the audience sometimes, even though it's a masterful performance, is sort of slow to really react because it looks so darned easy.
Oh, well, there you are. It's the art that conceals the art, you see. We both know it's difficult, but we try and make it look easy.
There are no markings. The original score has no tempo markings at all. So how do you know how fast to take it, Chris?
Common sense. And, I mean, if you look at a piece, there's certain passages that will only go at one speed. If you do it too fast, they won't get all the notes in. And the character and the style tell you usually what the tempo is. And in any case, the first movement he would have put Allegro, which is what he normally put. And the second movement he'd have put Andante or Andantino, which is what he normally put. And the finale, probably Allegro non troppo. I'm not sure what he'd have put, but it's pretty common sense. And I find that most people do this particular concerto at very similar tempi. You don't get a wide range of tempi in interpretation that I've heard. Have you, Joyce?
It's pretty, common. I think it nails the mood and the texture he's going for, and to achieve all those hidden messages that he left in the score, it needs to be in certain range of tempo.
Yeah. The other thing about the audience and Mozart, you see, in Rochester we have a very sophisticated audience, but a lot of audience think that piano concerto means flinging yourself around and fireworks and octaves everywhere. And unfortunately, nowadays we're training people to listen with their eyes and not their ears. So this all militates against music with enormous depth and enormous simplicity and slightly lacking in the flashy department.
So the final piece on the program is another one that is lacking in the flashy department.
Oh, I'm not sure about that. There's a very brilliant scherzo in this, and it's extremely... You're talking about Sibelius' First Symphony, aren't you? Yes.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, it's extremely passionate, extremely energetic, highly dramatic, and throwing chunks of mountains from one mountain to the other. You know, you have to understand Finland and the legends and the forests and the gods and all the sort of Nordic legends up there, and he gets into that. Not by quoting folk tunes, but by a general setting of an atmosphere. And it's the slow movement has one of the saddest and yet simplest themes I know. It's quite extraordinary, and yet it is so simple and so understated. The scherzo is a rollicking sort of number where the theme is first played on the timpani. And then the finale, people say, oh, it's a little bit like Tchaikovsky. But here's the thing. Sibelius never again wrote a piece that was a little bit like Tchaikovsky. And when we get to the end of the magnificent theme, all the strings, near the end of the slow movement, the music actually disintegrates and becomes strange harmonies. And it's as if Sibelius's world of Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, and all the people who influenced him was disintegrating. He was going to move on to something quite different, which indeed he did.
The language is very different in this from where it begins and where it ends. I listened to this symphony yesterday, and as it was beginning, it had this really traditional, romantic feel to it.
Well, it's a lonely clarinet, isn't it? It begins with a quiet drum roll and a lonely, lonely solo on a clarinet, and then the sun bursts in. And the dramatic wit starts. But yes, the beginning is like, as you said, done in that way. But the end has just got these very powerful chords. And then when you think it's finished, they're two quiet plum, plum, pluck notes on the strings. And there's a sort of resignation about that.
I have to say, I think Sibelius ends symphonies better than almost anybody.
Well, he does it abruptly. He very abrupt. And yes, if you like abrupt, you've got it.
It was it has drama within it.
Yes.
But it is not an overtly big, like, Beethoven's ninth style of drama in it. It feels like this trip we're taking, this journey that we're taking through darkness and light and heroics.
Yes, I go along with that. And the use of the orchestra is extremely powerful. A lot of wonderful use of the brass of all sections of the orchestra, wonderful woodwind writing, colours change all the time. I think it's a wonderful symphony. And anyone who hasn't heard it before, I envy them, because hearing a piece like this for the first time is really quite an experience.
You are fond of Sibelius. This is a known thing. There are people who would say Sibelius is the worst symphonic writer ever.
Well, that tells me nothing about Sibelius, but it tells me a great deal about the people who say it.
Yes, now let's talk about that. Why would somebody feel, because you and I are agreed that Sibelius is a genius, why are people put off by that?
I have no idea. But not all the pieces are equally easy to approach. The Fourth Symphony is a very bleak piece, and it's quite difficult to do, and it leaves you in it doesn't scratch you where you itch in the way most people hope will happen in a symphony. So he was quite varied, and that is really dark, the Fourth Symphony. It's really dark, and he was experimenting. You know, he lived at a time when he felt change was needed in the way you write, and one of his bigger developments was, instead of writing the theme and then developing the theme, he'd write the development fragments first and then bring them together as a theme, which he does in the Third Symphony. So you get the development before the exposition. It's back to front. And some people found that very, very strange, that you got little fragments of bits and pieces. What is this? Ah! And then it coalesces. But that's the reverse of a Tchaikovsky symphony, who gives you the theme on a plate and then plays around with it.
As his symphonies go, do you have a favorite? I know, it's like asking, you know, it's like asking.
Well, it's the one I'm doing this week, whichever week it
whichever
is.
So
it's
it.
But the second is, we've done the second here, we've done the fifth here. Guest conductors have done the fourth, seventh as well, I think. No, they're all magnificent. But I've got a soft spot for this one, I must say, number one.
Number one really feels like a beginning. And it also feels like that transition. All at the same time, he's starting here. This is not where he's going to end up.
You can smell where he's going to go, though. You can sense the seeds of change.
Where do you find that? Where, somebody who's never heard this before, hearing it for the first time.
I think all the surprises, all the unexpected things. Oh, here's a guy who's different. And, of course, he got more and more different. And then he gave up composing. He never wrote an Eighth Symphony, although apparently he worked on it for years. And he promised a number of conductors that they would do the premiere of it. And then he died having put it in the stove.
Yeah, that's the story, that he ended up burning the whole thing, which would be a real sad.
Well, he thought it wasn't good enough. I mean, Brahms burnt a lot of his early pieces. He just thought they weren't good enough. And Dukas, who wrote The Sorcerer's Apprentice, burnt nearly everything, which is a real shame, because that's a masterpiece. La Pairie, the ballet, the poème dansé, that is a masterpiece. So I suppose that's the price you pay for having high standards.
Do you miss being a music director?
Yes, I do. I mean, it's wonderful to be back. And we're all the way we were. It feels absolutely wonderful. So in that sense, yes, I do. But I do enjoy guest conducting. I enjoy it very much. I think it swings and roundabouts, really.
And Joyce, what are you working on next? The last time you were here, was it the Gershwin that you were playing? Or you played like a big American thing the last time you were here. This is a little different. What are you working on now?
Right now, I am very excited for a series of concerts I will do with the Aspen Santa Fe Ballet. Choreography has always been something it's spectacular in my mind, and I didn't know how I would work with a choreographer and a dance company without just accompanying them from the pit and having no say in actually marrying the movements with the music. And after 4.5 years of planning, it's finally happening. I spent a month with the 12 dancers last summer, and we will do our premiere next year in March. And it will be a piano recital with piano on stage. And we'll play the music of Janáček, Philip Glass, and then the piece that we are have commissioned for this project is Schumann's Carnival. And that is an original choreography by Jorma Elo, Finnish choreographer who used to dance for Netherlands Dance Theater. And they were my, you know, what I watch after I was done with performances. I would go to my hotel room and just watch whatever I could find that they did, you know, night after night. So this is really something very exciting in my mind.
Musicians who have done this before, worked with dancers, say it is such a different performance.
Yes. I thought I really knew every note of the Schumann Carnival. I played it for over 10 years, performed it, I can't tell you how many times. And working with the dancers, everything I knew about this piece just melted. And what they heard sometimes is completely, it's something I never heard myself, even if I dissected it to pieces. And they just think into different phrasing. I think musicians just have we talk in upbeats and downbeats and four measure phrases. And these are the things that are building blocks. And they would ask me, how many turns are there? And I'm like, what turns? What are you talking about? You know, the language is different. So we just have to go by energy levels, really. And you should look at my music now. It's, you know, one note, it says, wait for the elevator. And one note, it says, you know, it just has all these images of nature and all the vocabularies I knew about music has just gone out the window. And it's a very exciting process.
Do you mean that you have to play it differently to accommodate what the dancers are doing?
Yes. Not because they asked me, but they sometimes hear a lot of movement in silences. I think that's very significant. The choreographer sometimes hears extreme panic in some silences, and some silences you hold still, and some silences are there to make you feel that anticipation, to make you feel uncomfortable for that split second. And he creates these spectacular movements, and I'd be an idiot not to wait for them to have that to bloom, whatever he's creating, before we can get to the next section. So I think breathing is a little bit different now. And sometimes I have to, if we're climbing toward a climax and I see them moving a little bit slowly today, because I spend so much time with them, I know exactly where to meet them and to wait for them so they can meet me, and then we can climb together. It's no one's rushing forward. Everyone's waiting for each other and noticing what's going on. And so it is everything I wanted it to be, sort of chamber music between different forms of art.
I do hope someone's going to film this.
Yes, it'll be filmed when we the week that we finally put it all together. It's almost ready, but I think that final process with the lighting designer, which I have not seen it with the lights and the positioning of the hall. So it'll happen in March. I'll make sure everything's documented.
You'll be on stage. You won't be put in a pit like a ballet orchestra, will you?
I will be on stage in costume.
Good. And I want you in a pit. It's going to be terrible.
And I do have a couple of things, movements I need to do. I am not dancing by any means, but there are some places where they will rush toward me, and I will fling myself up in the air as a result of something, and that's to be worked out. I think that's what I'm worried about the most.
Can't they bring you in on a wire?
Yes, I should just come from floating from the...
I was thinking skateboard myself.
I can rise to the stage on top of the piano.
And that works as well, too. I want to thank you both for coming in and spending time with us. It has been a real pleasure. Christopher Seaman, Joyce Yang, thanks for taking time to be here today. If you would like information about the Rochester Philharmonic season, you can go to rpo.org. Thank you again, Chris.
Pleasure.
And thank you, Joyce.
Thank you.
I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.